ever wonder why I'm here, I do. One in five people is mentally ill, so if you'll count up and down your row, you'll know how many of us are here today. I'm a business consultant. I give advice and leave town. No telling what will happen after I leave. Socrates gave advice, but he forgot to leave town. He was given hemlock by the cattlemen of Athens. I'm going to leave afterward. But I'm proud of the associations I've had. I work with Oldsmobile. You know how that's worked out. I've worked with Southwest Airlines, and they're flying high. The only airline making any money, so I'm proud of that one. But I'm truly proud of my long-term association with the beef industry. I started way back in the late 70s, and I can remember being there in 86 when the checkoff started, trying to fire up the troops on how to do the best for that checkoff and make it represent what the producer really wants. And I was part of that. And in 1999, when the National Livestock and Meat Board was merged with the National Cattlemen's Association, they brought me in to work with staff on that issue, too. So it isn't as if I've been a foreigner in the industry, but I've been asked to be your host today, and I'm very pleased that you're here and very proud to be serving your association. You know, you made an investment to be here, and you deserve to have that investment pay off. And so we need all of us to be looking for better ways to make that happen. And as long as we keep a customer focus, as long as we keep our focus on what it is we're doing and why we're doing it, it's amazing how you can improve your business practices. It's amazing how you can come up with better ideas. You know the commercials that, you know, beef, it's what's for dinner? It's known outside this room. It's known by people who are not here today. They heard it. And in fact, some of the commercials have won awards. Now, they won at the Super Bowl, but they've won awards. And let's take a look at the most recent of those award-winning commercials. That closed that announcement, that commercial, that's a voice that can fill a room. I know that Sam the Man would like to be here today. He's unable to because of his schedule, but he thinks so much of our association and is so proud to be representing us with his voice. He fills a room. He fills a heart. Let's hear some words from Sam.
Hi there, ladies and gentlemen. This is Sam Elliott, and I'd like to welcome you all to Nashville for the 2003 Cattle Industry Convention. I'd also like to take this opportunity to say thank you to each and every one of you for the contribution you make to a rich heritage in this country. And I'm talking about beef. It's been an honor for me to work with you over the years and to help you keep the good word going out there in the marketplace. So have a good time this week. I hope all goes well, and I hope you have a lot of fun. Just remember, when it comes time for you to sit down for a meal, beef, it's what's for dinner.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sam. Sam Elliott. What a great representative. How many are actually from Tennessee in this room today? Would you raise your hand, please? This is the land of the volunteers, is it not? I know as a Kansas City Chiefs fan, it's the land of the Titans. And I guess there's a bunch of skaters around called Predators or whatever they call those people. But I guess you get excited about those things. But as an outsider living in Kansas City, visiting this town for probably the 20th or 25th time, I really look forward to Music City, USA. I like the idea of being near the Grand Ole Opry. Grew up on that thing. Still remember that thing hanging from their head, don't you? And forerunner of Hee-Haw and all those things. So it's a part of my fabric. And I'm proud to be here in Nashville. I'm representing your industry in Tennessee. I'd like to introduce two of our leaders. First, Dave Fugit, who is president of the Tennessee Cattlemen's Association, and Mark Barker, who is chair of the Tennessee Beef Industry Council, the Beef Industry Council. Yeah. Welcome, gentlemen. A pleasure. Yeah. Now, is there anything you'd like say to your guests?
Well, certainly. I'd like to welcome all of you to Tennessee, and more specifically the Nashville area. You know, Dave's good at this, isn't he?
He's a pro.
One other thing that I'd like to do, I've welcomed you to Tennessee and to the Nashville area, but one more thing I want to do, you know, I can't do this like Minnie Pearl did, but I'm going to try something to see if you're awake. I'm going to say howdy, and then you have to answer me. Okay, you ready? Howdy!
Howdy!
They're awake, Dave.
Absolutely!
Okay.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Mark, I don't know if either you and I have a chance against that, but tell us about how the business is doing here in Tennessee.
Dave, agriculture is by far the largest industry in Tennessee. Cattle and calves are the number one source of agricultural income in Tennessee, totaling almost 20% of a $2 billion industry. Beef cattle numbers in Tennessee rank nationally number 9, and the number of producers, we are number 4. We're glad to have everybody here at the convention, and I hope you have a good convention.
Thank you. Do you really have any advice for those of us who are attending this meeting?
One word of advice, or two words, have fun.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you. We're glad to be here. And before we meet some of our national leaders of this year and in the future, and before we hear about some of our programs, we're very excited about our keynote speaker this morning. I had lunch with him and heard some stories that really did inspire me. Hugh Seide, some of you know already, has covered the White House for 45 years. He's been bureau chief for Time Magazine, and as such, he has spent a lot of time ever since Eisenhower. He was there at Eisenhower and the U2 crisis. He was with Kennedy in Dallas the day he was assassinated. He was with Nixon on that day when he left the White House and climbed on that helicopter and left the presidency. He was in Vladivostok with Gerald Ford, in Vienna with Jimmy Carter, in Red Square with Ronald Reagan, and on that last day of George Herbert Bush's presidency, he was the only journalist on the Air Force One from Houston to Washington, D.C. He was with Bill Clinton as he tried to bring about and broker peace in the Middle East. And he's known little George Bush ever since he was a whippersnapper and until he is a man today. I'd like you to welcome, give a warm gentleman's welcome to presidential historian, distinguished journalist, and friend of the beef industry, Mr. Hugh Seide. You know, I feel like I'm a part of you. I've stayed in some of your homes, written about your ranches, eaten a lot of your beef, and supported you all the way in the great struggle with over the family ranches. And so I kind of consider myself one of you. There, David apparently got scared by spam when he was young. I have to tell you that I was doing a piece some time ago about World War II, the 50th anniversary of D-Day, and I did one on the home front. I was doing it about the beef and the cabbages and everything that was produced and the number of bullets and all of that sort of thing, and I called up Austin, the people who made Spam, and they furnished me all this marvelous material. Did you know that Prime Minister Thatcher was a Great Britain, later Prime Minister, was a little girl in those days, and she said she thought it was quite tasty. That's all they had, as a matter of fact. And Khrushchev said it saved Russia. Many people would have gone hungry. But the boys of the 8th Air Force, the United States 8th Air Force, said that if they really wanted to end the war quickly, they needed to fill up the bombers with Spam and drop it on Berlin. Well, I saw President Bush here on your video, and I saw him last night on television, and he was your speaker last year. A remarkable man. And I, too, think he's more or less one of you people. Now, when I get back to Washington, and if I have a chance to see him, I'm going to suggest that next time he do one of those short takes, he wave the hat that you gave him last year. Yes, sir.
just to emphasize the point. And then also, every now and then, I'm invited down to the White House mess to have a little something to eat. And in a quiet moment, I'm going to say, more beef down there. That Tex-Mex stuff is not really doing the job. So, I'm not against that. Anyway, these are tough times. We all know that. We saw him again last night, and already there's controversy. I had a note from his father, George H.W. Bush, not long ago, and he said, not since the Civil War have we really faced problems as difficult and as complex as this. I'm not sure that perhaps could be argued, but the fact of the matter is they are. They're tough. They're difficult. They're different. And George W. Bush is a different man. No, indeed. We just haven't sailed on these waters before. And I see that young man, and he is young compared to many presidents, at the White House the other night. We celebrated the 100th anniversary of the West Wing. That's the real thing, the real West Wing. Theodore Roosevelt built it in 1802. Taft put the Oval Office in 1809. And we had a symposium, and the president came. And he and Laura were up front, and I happened to be chairman of the White House Historical Association. And I sat back there, introduced him, and I sat back there, and I have to say I kind of moistened up. My eyes got moist. Because here was this young man who's given himself to this country. It'll never be the same. His life is essentially taken away from him. He's dedicated everything he has, his health, his time, his life, as never before. And of course, after 9/11, the intensity of that was all around for us to see. If you're looking for a president that can talk like John F. Kennedy did at the Berlin Wall, I was there, I stood underneath it, and I heard one of the most remarkable speeches I've ever heard any time. If you're looking for that man, George W. Bush is not him. If you're looking for somebody who knows the world as Nixon did, or as his father, George H.W. Bush, that's not the man either. If you're looking for one who can snooze and do all those things that Bill Clinton did, no. You're one sharp audience, let me tell you. No. He's him. He's George W. Bush. We change him every time. We don't go by the old pattern. No, he hasn't any of that in his background. He can't quote poetry and literature. He's not an expert on popular music and that. He didn't go to all of the graduate courses. He did very well. He went to the Ivy League, but he wasn't the Rhodes Scholar. He didn't have a box score that said many things. But let me tell you, leadership in the Oval Office, in the White House, has a million pieces. And those presidents that figure out what it is that they have, the strengths they have, and use them, those are the presidents that succeed. What I can tell you about George W. Bush is he is decisive. He is bold. He is candid. He is loyal. He is decent. You realize we've not had a scandal worth mentioning in 2 years that administration has been in. And I have to say about George W. Bush, and I know him somewhat, not that intimately, but I know him somewhat, and I know the people around him very well. And I would say in my old Iowa manner, these are good people. We don't have to look behind everything they say or every maneuver they do to find if they're trying to cover up something or obscure something or trying to get something. I am convinced after watching that administration for 2 long years that they feel that the good of the country, the national interest, comes first. That doesn't mean they're right. It doesn't mean they'll even succeed. But what I see are these people, again, like the president, devoting their lives to this time in our national life. and they are trying to the best of their ability to figure out what is right and how to do it and how to make it work. You know, in leadership, that goes a long way. No, this is a difficult time. But let's talk about war just a little bit, because that's what's on everybody's minds here now. You know, one thing that I think we need to take note of at this time. So many of my colleagues in the media say, oh, it's such a tough time, and good heavens, we haven't had it before, and boy, every night, I'm just inundated, Judy Woodruff, and in the morning with Katie Couric, and then on and on all day, the talking heads, the blather that comes out over and over again. And you wonder how we survived that, if you talk about spam. But you know, many of them have short memories. And I think there's some out here that are even as old as I am. You know, when I was up on the podium the other night with Bush, he looked down and said, Hugh Seide has covered 10 presidents. That's amazing. And he turned back to me and he said, you know, Hugh, Ulysses Grant would have liked you. Well, I missed him by a little bit, but not that much, you know. But these people that talk about adversity and trouble, and I'm not denying it, as I've said, these are unusual times. But you know something, the last 10 years we have had so much peace and so much prosperity, we rather got out of training, I have to say. In my lifetime, I remember as a boy in Iowa, the desperation of the Depression, and then came World War II. And nobody knew what was going to happen. Oh boy, do I remember those nights. I used to work for my father's weekly. Those winter nights when the draftees would come gather in front of the old hotel to get on the trailways bus. It'd be raining and snowing, cold, leaving their families, their wives. And then later on, when I was working in the paper shop, I would sometimes recognize, and I would take the pictures of these draftees, I would sometimes recognize when the word came in that they died in battle or were missing in North Africa and Italy and the Philippines or wherever. And they talk about trouble. We weren't sure about that war. For heaven's sakes, Hitler was gobbling up Europe. The Japanese had taken over Asia. But we came through it. We did. You know, the love of freedom just drives this great American nation and its people. And they made it work. But then after that, of course, after World War II came Korea. And then the Cold War. I can tell you about the Cold War because I've written about it a good deal. And some of you, many of you remember it. It wasn't always easy. I can recall the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was called one day by Pierre Salinger, the press secretary, and he said, I want you on the pool for excavation, or to leave the White House. I want you to be on that pool of 50, the president, the cabinet, the key people, and there'll be a press pool. And we're going to leave if there's a danger of nuclear exchange. And so he said, keep within 20 minutes of the White House and check in every hour with the switchboard operator. So I did that for a couple of days, and then the thought occurred to me, what am I doing here? I mean, I'm going to leave my three kids and my wife to be incinerated, and I'm going up under that mountain. So I went in to tell Pierre, and I said, Pierre, get me off that list. I don't want to be on that. I didn't put some young guy, you know, and I'm going to stay here. And he said, well, it was a great duty and all that sort of thing. I said, I don't care. Stay, take me off that. You know, a little later on, I was talking to McGeorge Bundy, who was the National Security Advisor to President Kennedy. And I told him the story, and he threw his head back and laughed. And he said, you know, after they briefed us about how they were going to take us out to the mountain, he said, I went in to see the president and said, I'm not going to leave my family. I'm going to stay right here. Whereupon Kennedy threw back his head and laughed and said, don't worry, Matt, I'm going to stay here, too. But it was a tense time. kind of toughness, danger. And sometimes in Vietnam, and I remember when Richard Nixon said paratroopers down the Middle East because the Soviets were moving, and then when he bombed Haiphong in that war. You know, we've had many, many tough times. And in my personal experience, I was in the motorcade in Dallas, 50 yards behind the president's car. And when I caught up with the car at Parkland Hospital, there was this pink-gray foam all over the back seat. Flesh, brains. Secret Service man was wiping it out from the crushed red flowers in the front seat. And I sat there and I said, can this nation survive? I'd lost a friend. I'd lost a president. The administration was over. We didn't know in those first hours whether this was going to be indeed an assault on all our people around the world. So it's not been easy defending human or defending freedom at any time, and it's not easy now. We just got out of the practice a little. The real world has closed in again, and it's a different and difficult world. But you know, our presidents that we had were kind of marvelous. They could mix humor with it, and I hope George W. Bush does the same as we march into this uncertain humor. We can't give up our lifestyle. We can't give up laughter. We can't give up what we cherish so much. I remember all through the Kennedy time, that summer of 61, when the Berlin Wall went up and the Soviets beat us into space. And I went over one day to see the president. He was angry and he said, I want to get out of here. He said, let's go for a swim. I said, Mr. President, I don't usually bring my swimming suit when I come to interview you. He said, you don't need one. Follow me. Just like back in Iowa, there I am standing on the pool. I'm confronted with the grave protocol problem. Who takes these trousers off first? Well, I can tell you, he beat me. More practice. One of those things. And LBJ, you know, he was another rancher. I loved old LBJ. He was a wild man sometimes, but that comes with it a little bit. But I've known him since he was majority leader, and I remember when we got into the White House, he was a little prideful. And he used to fill Air Force One with plastic busts of himself that he had made up in three sizes, small, medium, and large. He'd lead them around the world as he saw people. He was up in Korea once, left the boys a big bust of himself, and as he spoke, he caressed himself. Most unusual thing you'd ever seen. In 1967, LBJ decided, well, his friend Harold Holt had been drowned in the surf or eaten by a shark. We weren't sure which. But Johnson said, down where I come from, we go to weddings and funerals. I'm going to say so long to my friend. And so just before Christmas, we took off. We went down to Canberra, Australia, for the service for Harold Holt, and then Johnson decided he would secretly fly out around the world and drop in on the Pope on Christmas Eve. Apparently thought the two had much in common on that night. And we did that. Flew all around the world. 4.5 days, one night in a bed, going around the world. And on Christmas Eve, six American helicopters materialized out of the mist over St. Peter's Square, terrorizing 20,000 people who'd come for the Pope's blessing that night. We landed in the Vatican, and Johnson went up into the Pope's library and gave him a plastic bust of himself. Well, we could still laugh. We could have fun. And even I made up, I wrote a piece and they put a headline on it, said, Around the World with Lyndon B. Magellan. And he didn't like it that much, but we made up and he said, well, you know, when you see those wonderful people out there, you do a lot of things that perhaps you shouldn't. That's one of those things that just comes on. The trouble's been with us, Nixon. Indeed. I stood in Lafayette Square on that night before he announced he would give up the presidency. It never happened before in our lives. Half the people were weeping, half the people were cheering. And I saw that light up there where Jerry Ford's office was, and I wondered what's going to happen, but we got through it. We came through it. And Bush, Desert Storm, George H.W. Bush, Desert Storm. Never have I seen a finer operation run from the White House than that, in which he gathered the coalitions of Arabs, the United Nations, the Congress, the American people. Fought the war and won it. We debate now whether he should have stayed longer, but I'm one of those who is not at all sure about that. That's a complicated thing, and hindsight is so good. We can do it. One thing I can tell you, I remember back in the days of Ike, what a stir it made when John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, said, to keep peace in this world, there are times you must go to the brink of war, and you must mean it. We're in one of those times now. We're at the brink of war, and this man means it. If I had to give you odds from Washington today, I'd say 80-20, 70-30, something like that, but there will be some kind of action, war, police action, I don't know what, because I think this man means it. But maybe that's the only way for some kind of miraculous change at the end. If you don't mean it, it's seen pretty quickly. And there he is, young, determined. He's learned on the job. But a remarkable, remarkable man. And I always consider him one of you, even though the last time I checked, he only had four cows. All longhorns. I don't know what you do with those, but you look at them, I guess. But I'll tell you what he did have. He talked to me one day, standing in the south lawn of the White House, and he talked about the land and the feeling for it, and how he would hear the trickle in those streams, and he made a little bass pond, and he would fish for bass, and he would just walk, and he would cut brush down. Remarkable. He loved it. You could just tell. He didn't want to go to Martha's Vineyard or these other places. He wanted to be out there. Even when it was 110, there was some bond there. And I think as an Ironman, I understand that. I think, too, that you folks are a huge, huge part of this country. Sometimes, perhaps not even appreciated by you. In numbers, you can't compare with others. But you sustain the romance, the legend. You sustain the whole idea of America. You sustain freedom in so many ways. Individuality, initiative, endurance, toughness, courage. All those things that I mentioned when I talked about President Bush. The struggle will never end. I'm absolutely convinced that the best stewards, and I've looked at this country from all ways, the best stewards are those people who live on the land. No, indeed. And I think also just in terms of preserving freedom, of just understanding it. So what I say to you is, hang together. You mean so much to this nation. Never yield, just like George W. Bush has told you. Thank you.
Well, we've prevailed on you to join us for a conversation. Chandler Keyes, our Vice President of Governmental Affairs. They haven't changed that title since Clinton was in office.
No, they still call it Affairs.
Yeah, Affairs. All right. Yeah, he can do LBJ humor.
We'll do one on time. Okay.
change our vocabulary, didn't you? Thank the two of you who got that. I appreciate it.
It's a fast group over there, right?
Okay. We have real serious things going on, and my first question was basically, you know, how imminent is war, and I think you pretty well answered that for us. We're all interested in the economy, too, and we know that whatever we have to do to support our boys, we're going to do. But if the 80% happens and we go to war, how do you think that's going to affect the economy?
Well, at least in the short run, it's always kind of bad news. Nobody knows what's going to happen. You know, again, a lot of my media friends say this is nothing but a war about oil. And my answer is, of course it's a war about oil. I mean, without oil, with a serious disruption of our energy supply like that, this civilization is in terrible trouble, as Europe is. Yes, it's a war about oil. It's not a war to try to claim oil or to claim territory or anything. It's a war to have a reasonable open market and distribution of oil. So, indeed, that's a huge part of it. And if it's disrupted, if there's trouble, yes, that affects the economy. But let me tell you, again, we've also been through these things, and my record now stretches a long way back to the Suez Crisis, the Lebanese War, all of these things, and it tends to straighten out after a while. People adjust to it, and if there's a kind of a reasonable organization by the government response, we can live with it. But now we get to another question of one of thousands, of course, about the war. How long will it be? War is very impossible to predict. Eisenhower used to say that these battle plans are the most beautiful things in the world until the first bullet is fired, and then they're worthless because everything caves in on you. And so what happens? Remember the mother of all battles? Remember old Saddam before? It was over in 100 hours. And so what's going to happen over there? I don't know. A lot bad could happen. It could go wrong. Somebody could kill a battalion of American troops with bio war or the gas. I don't think he has nuclear weapons yet, but there could be some catastrophe in there.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it just might be quick. It might be a few days and over. We have so much power, so much of it, we don't even know about. And I think it would be a huge application right off. So, you know, your guess is as good as mine, and I would just say in the short run, yeah, it's going to be a rough time.
If we could, Hugh, if we could move away from the war and the war's effect on the economy for a moment and talk about the political situation in Washington, for the first time in a long time we have the administration of one party and the Congress of the same party. And I'd like to ask both of you, how is that different from what we've been going through maybe in the last 10 years?
Well, let me just tell you a little story. Then Chandler's been closer to that than I have. The old LBJ, when he had all those people up there, I remember he went in one night and he said, damn a majority. He said, none of those guys will listen to me. They all figure there's so many votes, we don't have to pay attention. We aren't loyal. And so I wouldn't count on it being too easy to get the Republicans.
Just because they're together.
Just because they're...
How's it looking from your point of view as our representative in Washington, Chandler?
Well, I think, you know, we've got a 50-50 Congress, so you really can't expect grand big things out of the Congress. What I think it really does is it frees up this administration to do some bold things administratively on environment, food safety, some issues like that, where they won't have another party in control of a body pestering them all the time through hearings and that kind of application. So it's really an opportunity, if you listen to the president last night, his first part of his speech was about a domestic agenda. And a lot of that domestic agenda will roll around the statutory authority he already has. So it's time to be bold. I think he understands that. He just has this a complication. We're trying to do all those domestic issues with a war and how you juggle all that. And I know some of my friends at the White House and administration right now are just dreading the 24/7 days that they're going to be living in the next few years. But that's how I look at it.
And then there are those initiatives that the president is behind. Are there some special priorities there for the cattlemen here today?
Well, as we know, we went through 8 years of the Clinton administration, particularly at the Interior Department. And we had a fight on with Bruce Babbitt for 8 years, and it was a bad fight. And now we have to go in and retool what he did to on the Endangered Species Act and on our western ranches. So I think we're going to have some opportunity there, and I hope that we take the advantage, and I hope this administration takes advantage of doing that.
I think, David, I think one of the things that the election reflected was a conservative cast to the nation.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a better appreciation of individual initiative, businesses, the toughness to struggle, farms, ranches, every place. And I think that's reflected in Washington, even though the votes may not work out all that the same. But I think the environment is pretty good now for that kind of approach. And we'll just have to see how it plays out when we hit the box scores.
Well, with that kind of climate, what kind of strategies do you see, Chandler?
I don't want to broadcast them, but we've got a really good staff in Washington. We've got great volunteers. I mean, this administration, we're closer to this administration, this industry is, than probably any administration that the cattle industry has ever dealt with in 100 years. We have people that work for the cattle industry that are in this administration. They have our viewpoints at heart. The White House calls our office practically every day, talking about initiatives and all kinds of departments. So I think we have a great opportunity. The key is, can we seize upon it? The key is, can we unify together and come to agreement amongst ourselves to take the opportunities that we are being presented to in this political climate? And that's one of the reasons we're here at this convention with 6,000 producers trying to come to some kind of consensus on some difficult issues, to go to politicians and say, we're unified, we've had a meeting, we know what we want, help us achieve those policy goals. And I think we have the resources to do that if we just figure out how we can unify and come to those conclusions.
Well, look, that's all of all those candidates. You know, half the people in Washington are running for the presidency. They tend to listen a little more, like this guy. They're a little softer. You take your arguments to them, and at least they feign sympathy, but I think in some instances they really listen.
So with what's going on, whether we have war or with the economy and all, we're all, I think the producers are first of all citizens. And do you ever have any advice for how we get through these difficult times? Any advice to us as citizens?
No, I just think my feeling about it is you march on as we have before through wars and depressions. You know, you gather your people around you and you make a little sacrifice here and there, but you keep your eye on that old flag and freedom. What we've got here is so precious and so wonderful. I just, you people have traveled too. You've been around the world and there's just nothing like it. And so you do what has to be done. You just do what has to be done.
Chandler, anything to add to that?
Well, I'm just so excited. I grew up listening to Hugh Seide on TV, and our family and my dad's in the audience, and we used to watch the event Bronson Company, and I'm sitting up here with you, so I'm kind of overwhelmed, but I would say that I'm a big history buff, and our founding fathers put this nation together over 200 years ago, and I've been reading these books about Ben Franklin and Jefferson and Washington and Adams, and what these individuals had in mind for this country. And I think rural people, particularly cattle producers, really embody that, and we need to remember that, and what the sacrifices they put forth, and our responsibility to continue to carry out those roles that were put together all so short 200 years ago. In the human history, no group of people have done so much in 200 years. Never, ever. Not the Greeks, not the Romans, nobody.
Like,
and we have a legacy to continue.
Yeah, you have that legacy.
No, I do.
Yeah. Then again, here's the last shot. You saw how wrong they feel about you here.
That's good.
Let's just give you the final word.
Yeah. Well, the final word is just hang in there. Keep smiling. Keep your sense of humor. Keep doing what you're doing. Do it better every day. And work out. Have a little sympathy for the tough job in Washington. It's a hard role now. Those are the trenches where so many of the battles are fought. But you've got good people. You know, I ran into Chandler. I didn't have a clue about him. I wanted to know something about ranchers. And I ran into him. We got together. And I thought, good heavens. There's nobody in Washington with as much common sense who's that young. That was a long time ago.
Gentlemen, thank you so much.
We appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Good job. Hearing all that history reminds me of stories I heard as a kid. My father would always take us for a family ride, and since he brought his boys up in a business, a tire business, and growing up on the farm, he wanted us to learn the values of the farm. And so after Sunday dinner, we had to make our ride. And sometimes we'd go by the same farmhouse three times, and my mother would say, "Are you lost?" And my father, of course, would respond that he wasn't, and to prove it, he'd drive around it again. I think there's a correlation between that role my father played and my mother, because if we were ever lost, somehow a map got into my mother's hands, and she was responsible if we were lost. Is that still the way it works in families? And so if you were lost on the way over here, we know whose fault it was, right? Oh, my. You know, we couldn't do anything in this business without our partners. And this morning's general session is sponsored by Fort Dodge Animal Health. And I'd like to introduce a leader among our partners, Scott Borman, who is the vice president with Fort Dodge Animal Health for livestock and equine. Welcome, Scott.
How are you?
I've got three prepared questions here I'm supposed to ask Scott, and we did a really good job in rehearsal, but I'm befuddled at the moment. I'll do my best to find it here, okay? The partnership with this association, what does that mean to Fort Dodge?
The Fort Dodge Animal Health has had a long-standing partnership with NCBA and the cattle industry, and that's demonstrated by our loyalty in the beef business. For over 90 years, we've been researching, developing, and manufacturing products for the beef business, products that enhance performance and maximize profits. And our participation at the convention, our partnership with NCBA, allows us to more closely align ourselves with the beef business and our customer.
And is there something in particular that Fort Dodge tries to do to make a difference in this industry?
I think Fort Dodge, David, really does two things that come to mind. First, I believe, is innovation. Innovation in technology by providing products, products that enhance performance, products that improve the health of cattle, products that allow you to maximize profits, products like Cinevex implants and the SX10 gun, products like Cydectin, which allow us to maximize profits but yet maintain environmental responsibility, products that offer vaccine technologies that allow us tissue-friendly administration, that adhere to VQA guidelines that are endorsed by NCBA. And I think more importantly, one of the things that we do is people, David, people dedicated to the beef business, people like Dr. Frank Crotty, director of our professional service staff, our technical service staff, people like Marion Hill, one of our corporate account managers, people like Dr. Jody Wade and our professional service staff, and also people like Mr. Stacy Turner, our local territory manager here in the host state of Tennessee. All people dedicated to the beef business, serving customers and trying to provide value to our customer base.
Well, how can I, as an individual producer, make a difference?
I think basically as we sit out here today, and I say we in terms of cattle producers and we in terms of manufacturing people and businesses, we can get involved, or we can make a difference by getting involved. Getting involved at the committee level, getting involved in the issues that are going to mold our business. If you look at the beef business, a very proud heritage, a business that's been built on integrity, hard work, and collaboration. Collaboration being a key driver there, because with collaboration allows us to create change, and change which will allow us to mold our business to be more competitive and mold our business for the future. And I think lastly, David, get involved in the educational process. Over the course of the next few days, you've got a wealth of information in front of you. Down on the trade show floor, you've got industry experts. In a lot of the meetings, you've got business leaders. Get involved. Take one thing home from the convention that will allow you to improve your business or operation to make the beef business a better place today.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you.
A special thanks to our sponsor, Fort Dodge.
Thank you very much.
This association is blessed with great leadership, and it's my pleasure at this moment to introduce Wyeth Willey, who is your current president of NCBA, and D. Lacey, chairman of the Cattlemen's Beef Board. Here we are. We're going to have a conversation.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Dee.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi,
Wyeth.
How are you?
Good to see you. Give me a sense of how your organizations have been doing this year, and observations about the industry and these organizations you've been in touch with this year.
Well, I think the industry is doing very well. We've come through some times of very heavy supplies, but our beef demand has gone up thanks a lot to our checkup and all the work our organization staff has done. And that extra demand that we've had has probably added another $100 to every steer that goes to market.
That's significant.
That's significant. And as an organization, I think we're on track. We've been able to keep our focus. As you can tell from listening to Chandler, we have a great deal of influence in Washington, and we're an effective organization.
Terrific. And what did you observe this year?
You know, I've had the chance to travel around the country, and one of the things that I've observed most is the amount of support that we've got for the checkoff program.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, maybe a second observation would be that there's a communication gap. Many of the producers don't know that their checkoff dollars are being used for some pretty tremendous programs. A lot of them see the TV advertising, and they see it in magazines, and they say, that's my checkoff dollar. But they don't know some of the important other things in beef safety and issue management and relationships with health organizations that we've used those checkoff dollars to do. At the same time this year, while we've had some communication challenges, because we've been under a kind of gag order from a court, it's been about 2 years now, kind of opponents of the checkoff have been able to just kind of go out there and spread misinformation, and that's been a little hard for the producer to understand and really know which side to come down on. And then probably the third observation would be that as the buying power of our dollar has diminished over these last 15 years since we passed the checkoff, we've had to really look at forming partnerships. And we've kind of heard it from Scott, that partnerships are important. And this year we've seen the last few years we've been able to develop tremendous partnerships with retailers, like we did with our summer grilling program, where major retailers put up dollars to join in advertising. And Taco Bell, we put up $500,000, they put up $65 million. That really leverages those dollars that, you know, we don't have as many of. And probably our most important partnership is the one that we've shared. It's a traditional one for us, and it's been a long time relationship. It's with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. They're the number one trade organization that supports beef, and without them, we couldn't be carrying out a lot of the checkoff programs that we do.
Well, give me a sense of how these organizations that you are working so hard with, and didn't just, you weren't born today into these organizations, you all been working for a long time. How they've evolved?
Well, you heard Chandler talk about 200 years ago, over 200 years ago, forefathers developed, you know, the Constitution and the scheme for this country, which has been a wonderful experiment. And over 100 years ago, people got together and formed our forerunner of our organization. So we've got a lot of tradition and history. And we've built up that tradition and that effectiveness over a long period of time. About 15 years ago,
cattlemen got together and decided to take their own future in their hands and to have the beef checkoff, a self-help program. They got that through Congress, and they got that through a popular vote of the producers, and it's been very effective. Then in 1996, all the cattle organizations got together and had a merger with a new vision, and frankly, that new vision and all that hard work toward that vision has been what has helped our demand.
Yeah, and then in 2000, the NCBA, CBB, the Cattlemen's Beef Board, the American National Cattlewomen, NEF, we kind of came together and we adopted the industry long-range plan. And that really did make us focus our dollars, our energies, our resources on some specific goals. And, of course, the number one goal was to raise beef demand by 2004 by 6%, and we're well on our way to doing that. And I think that's kind of collaboration with all the groups is pretty impressive.
Now, either of you had a chance to catch us in the hallway. There's a lot of that going on. I noticed on my way over here. Conversations. If you have 30 seconds with me, we're not worried about where I'm from and all the social part. But if you could give me a piece of advice as an attendee at this conference, as one of the producers, what would you say to me?
I'd say the first thing, you can't get past the social part.
Okay.
You have to say hi and how's it going,
right.
And it's always what's the weather like, or how's the food and the price of cattle.
Right.
So you kind of get past that, and then I, as the chairman of the beef board and representing my officers and the team, I'd say, thank you very, very much for giving up time from your farms and ranches to come here, collaborate, deliberate, discuss and test, and then really come together and share a common goal about strengthening the marketplace. Hugh Seide, when we were back there, we thought, oh my God, we've got to go follow Hugh Seide and Chandler. But he said, what did he say at the end? Just do what you have to do to get it done. And we need to raise beef demand and keep beef the center of the plate. And I think we take Hugh Seide's advice and just do what we need to do to get it done.
And while as you finish your year, that 30-second commercial you give us,
I would tell people, first of all, this is your organization. Take an active role. This is your chance to have your viewpoint heard. And don't be bashful. I'd say to have fun. I'd say you're part of a great industry. And go home and sell a membership to your neighbor. You can't be around this industry, but help them to realize that the American dream is alive and well in the cattle industry.
That's great. Thank you very much for what both of you do. Don't these things great? Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Aren't they terrific? We all volunteer, all of us, in our lives and give our time to things that we believe in, and if that ever goes away, we're in trouble as Americans. It just makes you proud, doesn't it, to see your representatives do such a good job and care so much about your industry and your families. Speaking of families, just one more time before I take us to what I think is maybe the highlight of our morning program, and we've had all the highlights so far, but we've got more coming. We'd go for those rides I was talking about, and my dad felt an obligation to teach me about economics, before I go to college. And we'd ride in the car, and we'd go by a farm that would, very prosperous, but the farmhouse would be much bigger than the barn. And my dad would say that's because the woman's in charge. She wears the pants in that family. That's why the house is bigger than the barn. So then we go by another farm. It's a nice house, but the barn was much bigger. And he'd say, well, the man wears the pants in that family. And then we go by this great big prosperous operation with all the hardware stores and storage units and the barn, multiple barns and two or three houses. And I'd say, Dad, who's in charge there? And he'd say, the bank. So I learned about economics from my father. Something's been going on this year. Gary Stokes become your new chief executive officer, and town meetings have been held all over the territories and in different locations, and we've had a lot of you. How many did attend one of the town meetings? We would like to open this forum to give you a chance to participate in a town meeting
with your chief executive officer. We've allowed a period of time here. We're going to ask Sarah Terry some questions. So I'd like you to please welcome Terry Stokes, our chief executive officer of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. I have an opening question I want to ask Terry about those town meetings. Why were they so important to do?
Well, the reason that they were so important is that they've, over the last couple of years, they've lost a lot of money. They face some tough conditions with the drought and other things. And it's important for us to listen and understand these issues and their concerns so that we can more effectively serve them and find the right solutions. You know, it's easy for me to sit in Denver and understand these issues. But more importantly, it's important for me to visit with our folks on their ranches and in their hometowns to get a real understanding of the intensity of these issues and how they're affecting them at home, and look at ways in which we can provide and work on solutions that can increase the profitability on their farms and ranches. You know, when I was growing up, my dad started a business in 1960, and he built that business on providing excellent products and excellent service. And I remember when I was working on the shipping dock, I was about 18 years old, and I forgot to load some product on the truck for a customer in Alpine, Texas. Well, the next day, I was delivering that product to that customer in Alpine, Texas. So it's all about the customer.
Yes, it is.
And it's about our people. Our people have big hearts, they're resilient, and they know how to rebound from this. But it's important for us, as their organization, and as I work for them, to be able to understand those concerns. And they see my phone number on the screen and my email address, and I work for them, and they can get my phone number, and they get my email, and they can call me and talk to me anytime.
Are you ready to answer some questions from the town meeting?
The way
we're going to do this, we're going to have some staff people from the association in the audience, and would you all stand so we can see where you're located, hold up mics, and I'll move down into the audience too, and the right here, okay, right back there. So we would invite you to move from your seat and to a microphone. We'd like you to identify yourself, what your role is, whether you're a producer or a partner in the association, or just exactly, you know, where you're coming from and where you're located, and then ask us your question so we can be sure to target in on exactly what it is. Now, as host, I was given some questions, Terry, and so I'm going to take the privilege of asking you this first one. This might be a little bit lonely, but see, I can handle it. There is a perception in NCBA that NCBA is detached from the producer. How do you respond to that question?
Well, I guess the way that I would respond to that is that perception is not reality. The reality is that we are a cattleman-controlled, industry-inclusive organization. When you look at who is at this meeting, who is going to be about making these decisions, it's about our cattlemen. You are the backbone of our organization. You are the ones that make the decision on policy. You're the ones that make the decisions on programs so that as we implement that and we look at our missions, which is to increase profit opportunities for our cattle and beef producers by doing two things. By enhancing the business climate in which you work, and secondly, by increasing demand. Those two things. But it's your organization. We work for you. It's cattleman controlled.
We're not really that shy. We have a question.
I'm Gene Harris from Gilder, North Dakota. I serve on the executive committee of NCBA as Region 7 Vice President. And in North Dakota, in our area, trade gives a lot of talk and takes up a lot of coffee shop time. And people are really concerned, producers are concerned, how will we compete as a cow-calf producer against countries like Brazil when we look at free trade agreements?
Okay.
Gene, that's a good question. I think the important thing is that we live in a global world today. Globalization is a reality. This country was founded in a global arena, as you look at how that was done. But it's not just about free trade, it's about fair trade. And how we compete is by having a level playing field. We can produce the best product in the most efficient manner possible. And the way that we do that is that we have a level playing field. We don't compete by the same rules that Brazilian ranchers compete by. They don't have the infrastructure that we have in place today to provide beef to the world. So I think when we look at that particular situation, how we're going to compete, it's about when we do trade negotiations on these free trade agreements. It's not just about free trade, it's about fair trade and having a level playing field. But it's also by looking at ways in which we continually can make our operations better, enhance our efficiencies, provide a more consistent product, because we are king of the center of the plate.
Do we have a question, gentlemen, anywhere?
Right over here. I'm Dale Spencer from North Central Nebraska in the Sand Hills, chair of the Nebraska Beef Council. I'm also on the executive committee for NCBA. Terry, earlier today you made a comment about a husband and wife team from Wyoming saying that they're unable to attend the national conventions, can't be here. They're calving at this time. And you said we've got to relate to those people. Do you have some ideas or some answers in how we do start relating to those people, make them feel like they're engaged in the process and feel like that they really are members of NCBA and that NCBA is working for them?
Well, Dale, I certainly don't have all of the answers. I think one of the key things that we've got to be able to do is we've got to reach out to our membership across the United States. We talk about how important this meeting and that there's 6,000 folks here. Well, you know what? There's 24,000 folks that are still at home. So how do we reach them? How do we connect to them? How do we provide a way from which they can provide input? You know, one thought is that maybe there's opportunities in the future where we can video conference through satellite uplinks or whatever, a convention, so that people can go to a central location in their area and they can plug in and be a part of the convention in that form or fashion. I don't know what the answers are. I know that there's some barriers to doing that. But it is an opportunity. It is something that we're going to have to really focus upon, because as I've traveled around visiting with folks, they want to be connected, they want to have input, they want to have ownership in the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Got a question over here again. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, Terry. Glenn Stonebrink from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Earlier today, our President Bob Skinner talked at the Cattle Fund about a survey that was done in the northwestern part of the United States. Over 70% of our ranchers, their largest concern was environmental lawsuits that are coming down the pike. You'd think it would be markets and disease and forage and weather and all those things that we have to concentrate on, or should concentrate on. But by golly, that's not reality. And reality is that these lawsuits are extremely expensive, and we need help. Whatever NCBA can lend in that regard, I know you can't just go out and fund these, but we need some corporate help. We need any kind of help we can, because if we lose these suits and a lot of our ranchers go broke, then we don't have a beef industry anymore.
It's a good point. And I think the thing that Glenn drives home in his comments is this. There are activists out there that flat dab don't want to do but one thing, and that's put us out of business. When you look at PETA or the CSPI, and I use the acronyms because I can't remember their name, but the thing is, they're activist groups and they're well funded. PETA's budget is $14 million. CSPI's got $15 million. Greenpeace Worldwide has $125 million. These are well funded activist groups, and they're about one thing. They're about moving us off the farm and off the ranch. Klamath River Basin is a perfect example. That's up in your area, I think, Glenn, as you look at it. It wasn't about fish, it wasn't about water. It's about we want you off the land. I think that's one of the roles that we want to play and that we try to do as your organization is look at how do we protect the business and the environment in which you work so that you can have freedom of choice about what you want to do and how you want to run your business, that you preserve your way of life, and that you pass your ranches on to the next generation, your kids. Another question. We're at the left side of the room. Load it.
Don Dowell, Somerville, Tennessee. I wonder if you could be a little bit more specific in what specific steps or recommendations NCB has proposed or would propose to create a level playing field with the proposed free trade agreements in Central American countries such as Brazil. And if this was a level playing field, what would be any reason that that would be beneficial to us as cattle producers when there's no need for us to, no opportunity at all for us to sell beef in Brazil?
Well, I think we have to look at Brazil in the context of the whole world, because what we face is that we want meaningful access to global markets for our product. One way that you have a level playing field is that you make sure that, that certain animal health standards are met worldwide, so that there's not, we don't put our industry in jeopardy through foot and mouth disease and other animal health diseases that are in place such as that. That you have the same sort of food safety inspection standards in the processing plants in Brazil that you have in the United States, so that that product is safe, is as safe as the product that we produce here. But more importantly, as we look at that, it's important that as we look at other countries where we have access to sell it, we want more access to Europe. We won't reduce tariffs in Japan. We won't reduce tariffs in Korea, because they are number one customers, and we know that there's opportunities there for us to sell our product and enhance the marketplace for our producers. So I think there's two things we can do. Animal health standards and food safety inspection standards are just two ways in which we can help do that.
We have one in the back.
My name is Bill Donald from Montana. I'm chairman of the Cow-Calf Council. And Terry, I want to thank you for your leadership in the town hall meetings. I know you came to Montana and made a very positive impression on the members we have there and the non-members we have there as to the integrity that you have and that you bring to the organization and that the organization has. My question is, the sense of feeling you got from the members that you visited with across the country, and you know, we have the proposal for a bylaws change to allow them to vote if they do not get the opportunity to come to the convention. Do you have faith in the integrity of those people to be communicated with by us and our leadership that are here to share the debate with them so they could vote in a knowledgeable manner?
Well, Bill, I'm going to pass it back. I'm going to pass that back to you as the owners and participants in this organization. Because if this body decides that that's the approach that we want to take to seek input from the country and for them to have a voice, then they will make the decision at that convention, and we're going to implement that such that people have the facts, they have the ability and the tools through the communication so that they can respond and respond back to us on the policy that you develop and pass at this meeting. It's your organization. That's a decision that this group's going to have to make, is how they want to reach out in a governance process to be able to do that.
Terry, I'd like to ask you a question. How many of these, it's kind of hard for us in this big room, obviously, to do the same kind of thing you were able to do out there in the territories, but about how many of these did you have? How many people showed up, and what sizes were they, and all that sort of thing, these town hall meetings?
Well, I think we've been to over 15 states. We've probably held over 30 meetings. It's been myself and Mark and Chandler and Kendall and some others that have participated in those. So I think we've had a far-reaching effect. You know, the groups are anywhere from a dozen to 150. As I look at it, it makes no difference to size. It's the quality of the discussion and understanding of the concerns that our people have in order that they feel more ownership in the organization.
Okay. I'm Jim Sundin from California. As a result of all of these meetings that you attended, do you have any ideas that you can tell us of what policies of this association could cause amending members to become dissatisfied and actually leave the organization, and what actions can we take to get these people back?
That's a good question. I think there's three central themes that I've heard as I've visited with folks around the country. And they've said to us, they've said to me in different ways, they said, you know, I want to be able to have the freedom of choice to operate my business the way I want to operate. I want to be able to preserve my way of life, and I want to be able to pass my ranch on to the kids, to my kids. So I think the number one thing that this body can do as far as leadership is that we have to secure the permanent repeal of the estate tax as soon as possible. The second thing that we need to do is that we've got to reduce and create opportunities for our kids to want to be a part of this industry. You know, when you look at agriculture in general, but you look at our industry, our organization, we're not getting any younger. Our average age is 58. So how do we create those opportunities so that our kids have a desire to also participate in the business that we have and preserve that way of life?
Yep. Gary, my name is Joe Tuga. I'm Region 5 Vice President and represent cattle producers in the Northwest. And I'm frequently asked the question or posed with the concern that the NCBA is nothing but an organization that represents the packers, and we're more concerned about their welfare than we are a cow-calf guy. How do you answer that, please?
The way I respond to that, Joe, is that we are a cattleman-controlled, industry-inclusive organization. Look across this audience. How many packers do you see? 63% of our board of directors in the policy division are cow-calf producers. They have a super majority to make any decision, establish any position that they want. 30% of our board of directors are feeder and stocker operators. 6% are allied industry members, and 1% are the packing industry. We are cattleman controlled and industry inclusive. When we look at the issues we face today, one specifically, and that's beef safety. Every time we have a recall, every time a kid gets sick from hamburger, it softens the demand for our product. That's the reason that we have to work with all segments of the industry on issues like that if we're going to increase beef demand for our industry.
Nicholas, I'm with the Utah Cattlemen's Association. I'm their Public Lands Committee Chairman. As you know, most of us in the West, public lands is a big issue. In the state of Utah, 73% of the acres in our state are owned by the federal government. And to our neighbors in Nevada, it's nearly 89% is owned by the government. We live under the constant threat of increased regulations, restrictions, and even removal in many cases. We have an issue in the state of Utah right now that is threatening to become a national crisis and could well be the end of public lands grazing. My question to you is, in light of this, it seems at times that maybe NCBA hasn't been as visible on some of these things as they could be. Do you see a need for NCBA to become a little more aggressive, more visible, and putting their arms around some of these public lands issues? Thank you.
Let me respond to that just by saying I think we have been aggressive on this public lands issue. We've somewhat had our backs against the wall. When you look at the administration that's been in place for the 8 years prior to President Bush, it was no easy task to address those. And we're working our way out of that particular situation. I think with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association's partnership with the Public Lands Council, protection of property rights are a top priority. Because what I've found is that where property rights go on public lands, property rights go on private lands, that will follow.
Terry, I'm Charles Miller. I'm a cattle producer from Kentucky. I think there's a real concern, I know, in Kentucky, and I feel like this is shared in a large part of those states east of Mississippi, that we aren't really considered as much a part of NCBA as we would like to think that we are. that MCBA is more or less dominated and representative of those Western producers. And that probably is not a true feeling, but I would like to know how you think that we could work together to try to alleviate that feeling in that situation.
Well, for a little time I've been in this position, let me share with you that our commitment is to all cattlemen across the United States. Whether it's in Washington or Kentucky or Georgia or Florida, our cattlemen have to speak with one voice if we're going to make a difference on the issues that we face today. And it's all about collaboration. It's all about working together. It's all about pointing the finger at the right people and not looking at the three fingers pointing back at us. If we're going to have one voice speaking for this industry, we're committed, this organization, and I think our leadership would speak to this time and time again, we're committed to all cattlemen across 50 states in the United States of America as the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Thank you.
Let me conclude with this. It's your organization. You have for the next 3 or 4 days the opportunity to participate in council meetings, committee meetings, in the board meeting, and in the membership meeting and making a difference. I hope that you will take an opportunity to do that. It's your organization. I work for you. If you have concerns, give me a call. You saw my phone number on the screen as we looked at that. I welcome that because I work for you. National Cattlemen's Beef Association is about protecting your business, promoting your product, and preparing for your tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Terry. Appreciate it.
Take some courage for a chief executive officer to get out in front of his people. We've had great examples in our country recently of not so great behavior on the part of chief executive officers, so it's great that we can have a dialogue. Please, please understand Terry's available. He may be rushing to a meeting, but if you get a chance to ask him a question or give him words of encouragement, please do so. You know, it's time for us to see the results of being involved, giving direction to this association in the area of public policy and our program efforts, especially in the areas of beef safety, nutrition, and new products. And to kick off this part of our program, Michelle Rossman, Associate Director of the Beef Safety with NCBA, will tell us what we're accomplishing.
Good afternoon. Today, I'm here to talk to you about beef safety. Consumer confidence in the safety of beef products is the cornerstone for beef demand. U.S. beef products are the safest in the world. And to maintain this high standard, beef safety must remain a high priority for the beef industry. Checkoff dollars are used currently to research many different beef safety issues. Those include BSE, the safety of non-intact beef products, as well as the basic science of foodborne pathogens. These are all very important beef safety issues, but today I would like to focus on our biggest challenge, and that is E. coli 015787. I'm sure you all remember the outbreak that occurred in January of 1993 in the Northwest. This outbreak, which was attributed to E. coli tainted beef, caused 700 illnesses and 4 deaths. In response to this outbreak, the beef industry organized a task force that put together a blueprint for industry action. As a result of this blueprint, checkoff dollars were used to fund the research and development of interventions that are used today to reduce contamination on carcasses as well as live cattle. The beef industry invested millions of dollars to implement these interventions, and today, over 90% of the carcasses processed in the United States are exposed to one or more of these interventions. Over the last 10 years, a $20 million investment of checkoff dollars has been made in the areas of research, public relations, consumer education, and issues management to address this pathogen. Unfortunately, in the summer of 2002, it became apparent that we still have a lot of work to do. This is when the largest recall in history occurred due to E. coli-tainted beef. In response, checkout funds were used for a meeting that we held earlier this month in San Antonio called the Beef Industry E. coli Summit. Attendees of this meeting represented production, slaughter fabrication, processing, food service, and retail sectors. Summit attendees had the opportunity to discuss best practices and interventions that can be incorporated into standardized food safety systems to ensure that we're serving the consumer safe beef. Let's listen to what some of the producers had to say about this meeting.
One of the things that I think you've seen that checkout dollars brought to focus with this summit is that it's from the ranch to the plate. And that's the important thing that we hope will come out of this, is what ranchers can do to help minimize the load of the E. coli on the animal when it goes to the feedlot. Then what the feedlots are doing, they're here. We've got representatives from the major feedlots looking at what they can do. And then, as I say, food service, the retails here, it's that all of us have to play a part in this.
But I'm especially proud of the progress that we've made at this summit, because I believe that we've seen the solutions put on the table that will make our product even safer for the U.S. consumer.
If we can institute some best practices at our operations back on the farms, then we can impact the solution to E. coli.
Quick service restaurants, as one of our biggest customers, are a vital part of the farm-to-table safety continuum. Let's listen to what McDonald's and Jack in the Box had to say about our summit.
If everybody realizes that it's everybody's responsibility to do their part to eliminate this pathogen from the food chain, it's not just a packer problem, it's not just a retail problem, it's everybody who touches these cattle, has anything to do with livestock or meat, beef, needs to understand it's their responsibility to do what they can.
The commitment that's coming out of this meeting is really impressive. You have people talking about working together and doing things much differently than they've done before, which will enable us to solve problems in different ways, can really solve this problem for consumers. The bottom line for beef consumers at this summit is that they can buy that product with confidence every day and know that the industry is standing behind it, doing all they can to make the product as safe as it can be.
NCBA's public relations team put together an impressive media package that resulted in over 15 million impressions. Let's listen to what the media said.
The beef industry wants you to know that you can now eat ground beef with confidence.
The first ever summit between the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and representatives from meat retailers and restaurants wrapped up today.
Summit attendees committed to new changes, including expanded research and fast-track approval of interventions.
The industry says it will work to develop a vaccine for E. coli infections,
more intense testing of ground beef before it reaches consumers,
and having knowledgeable workers in restaurants,
and supply better consumer information on cooking temperatures and the use of thermometers.
Industry officials say there has been a 24% reduction in E. coli illnesses in the last 3 years.
Some attendees had the opportunity to sign a pledge to consumers. This pledge signifies their commitment to reducing the risks associated with E. coli 015787 and articulates our united goal of producing, delivering, and serving wholesome and safe beef for each and every family. Today, as you leave this session, you will have the opportunity to sign this pledge and become a vital link in the farm-to-table safety continuum. Nutrition is another very important issue for the beef industry, and I'd like to introduce Mary Young, who will talk about our nutrition programs.
The nutrition issue for the beef industry started with the U.S. Senate Select Committee report in 1977. It declared Americans should eat less red meat and more poultry and fish. Until then, beef was considered an essential part of the American lifestyle and only a good food. This negative perspective has continued for 30 years, with the 1995 edition of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans recognizing vegetarian diets as healthful for the first time. In 2000, these guidelines increased their emphasis on lowering saturated fat and cholesterol. Last September, the Institute of Medicine released a report suggesting Americans should minimize their intake of saturated fat and cholesterol as they have no health benefit. This is incredibly important as animal products are a significant source of fat and cholesterol. And health organizations such as the American Heart Association closely reflect these guidelines. Despite all this, controversy remains about what makes up the ideal diet. In July, the New York Times ran a cover story questioning these recommendations about fat, asking, what if it has all been a big fat lie? And the overweight and obesity epidemic in this country will keep this debate front and center. But your efforts in nutrition policy and program keep beef on America's plate. We welcome the debate because we believe beef is one of nature's best-tasting multivitamins. From a policy standpoint, those 2000 dietary guidelines I mentioned were originally slated to read, "Choose foods low in saturated fat and cholesterol," which would have eliminated all but the leanest cuts of beef. Your efforts changed that wording to say choose diets low in saturated fat and cholesterol, which allows for the inclusion of all beef cuts. Moving on to checkoff programs, nutrition research builds and defends the case for beef. Last fall, a B vitamin symposium revealed new information about the importance of B vitamins to health. And next week, your public relations team will be sharing results of a checkoff-funded study with the American public that showed that high-protein diets may aid in weight loss. Your issues management team is always at work. Just 2 weeks ago, we responded to a Newsweek story that suggested reducing the presence of beef in the food guide pyramid. And we all know that the youth of America are consumers both today and tomorrow. The new Girl Scout program teaches girls about the importance of good nutrition and beef nutrients. And your state beef councils are instrumental in placing Fit for a Princess locally. In 1999, your health professional program created the Council for Women's Nutrition Solutions, or CWNS as we like to call them. This panel of nine scientists, dietitians, doctors, and psychologists have been reaching out to consumers, other health professionals, and the media on your behalf. And today I'm thrilled to welcome Dale Hayes, registered dietitian and CWNS member, to give you a snapshot on how she talks to consumers about beef.
Thank you, Mary, and thank all of you for inviting me to be part of your meeting. As a member of the Council for Women's Nutrition Solutions, I am honored to speak to thousands of consumers and health professionals every year. On your behalf, I talk to women about how beef fits into so many all-American meals and how beef can help solve some of the serious health issues facing Americans. These slides are samples of the actual slides that I use in my presentations to talk about power foods for power moves. Presentations where I tell consumers how your product is one of the top five power foods in America. In my mind, eating is never just about nutrition. It's about getting great taste and good health on the same plate. Beef does exactly that. Beef offers women and their families a food they love to eat and a delicious nutrition solution for today's overweight but sometimes undernourished Americans. My presentations are never just about nutrition. I also talk about getting your product onto American tables quickly and easily. However, we do have a powerful nutrition message to share. This slide is what I use to tell women about the profound effects of limiting their fat intake. The actual skeleton snapshot on the right is from a young woman who cut dairy, meat, and other foods out of her diet. Because of her food choices, she will suffer lifelong, painful, and irreversible health problems. On your behalf, I tell women how beef can fill their nutrient gaps with key nutrients that work as hard as they do. With the research and materials you support, I help women understand that beef is a power food that helps them and their families stay strong, build muscles, maintain bones, and balance blood sugar. Beef also helps to boost energy all day long. And when I listened to Mr. Sightly today and he talked about what we need to do in the tough times ahead, I thought, what we need, the energy we need to do that, can come from beef. I am able to offer a simple nutrition message, a simple solution, and a simple discussion of beef's nutrient bundle, zinc, iron, and protein that we like to call ZIP. That's just a small taste of the CWIN's message that I have taken and will be taking out to consumers and health professionals on your behalf. Thank you for inviting me to be here with you, and thank you for giving me the chance to share a powerful nutrition message with American families. CWIN's also talks to consumers about beef through the media, resulting in over 107 million media impressions to date. In addition to CWIN's media, the Nutrition Public Relations Program has been highly successful in placing positive beef stories in magazines and on TV stations around this country. And now let's listen to a news clip about our release of the new lean ground beef nutritional data.
Beef is about to get a boost.
For the first time in 20 years,
the USDA has announced new nutritional data
that shows ground beef can be just as low and possibly even lower in fat and in calories
than ground turkey or chicken.
To vary, those products are described generally by fat content, and a wider range of products is available.
The USDA updated its nutritional data because of popularity of leaner grades of ground beef, now available in the meat case.
Ground beef is also higher in many micronutrients like vitamin B12, zinc, and iron than ground turkey.
Isn't it great to hear a positive nutritional story about ground beef, especially compared to ground poultry? We're thrilled about it. This afternoon, you've heard about efforts on your behalf in both food safety and nutrition. Another important dimension of building beef demand is new products, and here to talk about that is Carl Blackwell.
It seems just a short time ago that we were here on the stage talking about microwavable pot roast, meat roast, and so forth. And I know the question that I got all the time was, Carl, you talk about these, but I can never find it on my grocery store. Well, I hope today that each and every one of you can go to your local grocery store now and go to the meat case and buy a microwavable pot roast. That's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the products that you can buy in your case and the products that are in the pipeline, because, folks, the pipeline is filled. And first, we're going to see a news clip on what the media thinks about your checkout-funded new product program.
CNBC presents Squawk Box with Mark Lee.
Mark, after losing out to chicken on the all-American dinner table for decades, beef decided to turn the tables on its feathered friends by using some of chicken's own tactics. Figure out a way to make more money out of every cut of beef and by making beef easier to use in everyday dishes. The researchers, technicians, taste testers of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association Culinary Center in Chicago, what they do is spend their time dreaming up and cooking up different ways to prepare and slice up beef.
This is the beef version of a boneless, skinless chicken breast. It's just as lean. It's tender. Um, it it's nutritious, and I think the best thing about this is that it tastes like steak instead of chicken.
Here may be the single greatest beef idea of all time, a cheeseburger fry.
Do they give the Nobel Prize for food?
I think they should if they don't.
I think they're too drunk.
They figured out several new cuts.
This will run you about 99 cents a pound on sale, and our goal is that we can create steaks out of here that might go from $4.99 to $5.99 a pound.
The Beef Value Cuts Program. Through an innovative cutting program, we are taking what has traditionally been merchandised as inexpensive roast, or in some cases ground beef, and turning them into moderate-priced, lean steaks that help us compete against those lower-priced chicken breasts and pork chops. Here's an example of one. Shoulder center steak, a great-tasting steak. A shoulder tender, a wonderful steak. And the very tender flat iron steak. Restaurants and institutions named the flat iron steak on trend for 2002. And you know what? They were right. Besides the hundreds of independent restaurants that are serving value cuts on their menu, these chains have put it on their menu. And the great news is that other chains have it in test. You can now buy beef value cuts, in this case, the flat iron steak, on the internet. Everybody in this room that has a computer can get flat iron steaks through Omaha Steaks. Retailers are testing at U-Crops and Costco. Maverick Ranch has used these as raw material ingredients in a new line of heat and serve products. And probably one of the most exciting new product launches this year is Tyson's launch of individually wrapped frozen beef value cuts that you'll find in the frozen meat case. It's going to start off on the West Coast, and if everything's successful, it's going to move east. So you folks on the West Coast, let's make sure they're successful. The next program I'd like to talk to you about is the Market Quality Program. This program is the symbol that is awarded by a group of 9 industry leaders that signifies that this product met our criteria for taste, quality, and satisfaction. Let's hear what the chairman of the Brand Like Initiative, Pat McDowell, has to say about this very important
one of
program.
The best investments of our dollar per head checkoff, because we are introducing new products to consumers. These products are more consumer friendly, and it just increases our chances to sell more beef.
We're supporting the Market Quality with a newspaper insert advertising. In this case, back in October, we reached over 40 million households with over 100 million coupons for convenient new beef products. We also did a TV commercial. I want to show you that.
If you like to know a good thing when you see it, look for the Beef Market Quality on products at your local grocery store. It's the sign of a great meal.
We have now over 63 products that have earned this mark, so it's making an impact in the industry. Let's shift gears one more time. Let's talk about the enemy. I don't like talking about the enemy very much, but these folks are doing a wonderful job. Chicken is doing a wonderful job in the supermarket deli section. They're selling over $2.5 billion worth of rotisserie chickens every year. And now beef is the fourth-ranked protein in that category, and fourth is not good enough for us. So your checkoff dollars is giving us a weapon. We've come up with a home-style pot roast product that we're merchandising right next to that rotisserie chicken. It's going to be served hot with vegetables. It's going to serve a family of 3 to 4 for $9.99. Let's hear what a producer leader has to say about this.
The deli pot roast to the beef industry would be an opportunity for producers to move more beef through the marketplace to consumers that would like to enjoy a pot roast but have no idea of how to cook one. So we've got the product here that is pre-cooked, that meets those needs, and that a family can enjoy without spending half a day cooking.
Now, where can you find those products. You can find it in Kroger in the southeast. You can also find it in Super Targets across the country. But ironically enough, the very first test of that product happened here in Nashville. And thanks to the great support of the Tennessee Beef Industry Council and Tennessee producers, this product was a success. We were able to launch it in other markets. So thank you, Nashville. Thank you, Tennessee, for your great support of this. Now let's hear what a local TV station had to say about this.
What do you do about this? Like regular family never life so busy. And Pat has a great answer for us today. A lot of the details we can tell the names of the contained and possible prepared foods, and we put them in our own containers, our own dishes, and finish cooking them, or finish putting the garnish on them, and nobody knows that you can make them so. You keep enough of it because you've got your dishes real. You smile and make them say, not the rest of this family can also have a secret. This is a dining room style beef pot roast with the vegetables. The onions, the carrots, the potatoes, everything is cooked and hot. And you can pick it up under the air where the rotisserie chickens are hot.
Yeah.
You can pick it up hot and take it home.
As with every new product, consumer support is vital. If we can't get consumers to support these products, we're going to fail. And everyone in this room is a consumer. And you all have power that you may not realize you have. We're going to give you a tool to see if you can help us build demand for beef. In the back of the room, as you leave today, there's going to be some folks in some blue shirts. This is our retail program. And what we've got here is what we call an Ask Your Retailer card. And on this card has all the vital information that a retailer needs in order to be able to sell this product in their store. We want you to go up to that deli counter and say, Mr. Retailer, I've heard about this product. If you were at the Cattlemen's College luncheon today, you tasted it. We want you to put this in your store. You would be amazed how powerful you can be. Can I count on your support to help us with this? I knew I could count on you folks. We're building demand for beef in the future, one product at a time, but with new products. New products is a lot of fun. I have fun every day when I go into work. I work with a great group of people. I work for a great group of people. And we even got the stiff guys on the financial TV station to have a little fun with us. So let's see that fun.
Nobel Prize winning. Cheeseburger fries.
And then there's also some of our great new value steaks to try.
Value steaks and cheeseburger fries. Have a cheeseburger fries.
Have a cheeseburger fries.
Yeah, by all means. Life does not get any better than that.
Don't talk with your mouth
on TV.
This is very good.
These are our new value steaks. They are the flattering steak you'll be seeing out there. It's a great value. Tastes as good as a ribeye or T-bone, but a much better value when you see it at the store.
That's very good.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Tender,
that's
flavorful.
Good. I'm curious. That's good.
Yeah, beef, everyone loves.
Okay, so I'd like to wrap some of that up and shake it with you. I'll just
Sarah did a great job. You've seen just a few policy and checkoff funded initiatives. But as you know, there's a lot more going on with your checkoff dollars and your policy dollars. We put together a little film to show you all the great things that are going. Let it rip.
change your mind.
And I'll tell you one thing. I could not have made all pro 7 out of my 13 years by eating fruits and vegetables. I had to pass away this week.
Seen is a brief recap of some of the results, some of the accomplishments you've achieved with your dollars. And I hope they make you proud. I hope they make you money. And I think they do. Because look what's happened to beef demand. Last year, virtually every major U.S. economic indicator plummeted. And yet we maintain strong beef demand in the face of record supplies of beef and competing meats. Do you think that didn't make a difference? What CattleFacts said about it is that had it not been for the strong beef demand, the increase in beef demand over the last 2 years, brought on in part by your beef checkoff programs, then late last summer and last fall, the Fed cattle market would have dropped to the mid-50s. We didn't need that on top of everything else. I hope these programs make you money. I hope you're proud of them. And I hope you agreed with Dave Schmidt, our MC, when he talked about that vibrant voice of Sam Elliott, that rich, gravelly voice that resonates like an earthquake. You couple that with Aaron Copland's Rodeo music, and that beef and what's for dinner message echoes through the minds of consumers like a steak sizzling on a grill. I know it does, because we hear from them. We get the phone calls. We get the emails, not just from producers, but from consumers who are coming back to beef because of what you're doing with the programs you fund. But you know what? Not everyone thinks this beef checkoff is such a wonderful idea. Make no mistake about it. Your program is under attack. That attack occurs in the courtroom. That attack occurs in some of the trade press. And you have to ask yourself, and maybe we ought to ask some of those checkoff opponents, if we don't have this self-help program for our industry, how do we get Sam Elliott to tell consumers beef is what for dinner? If we don't have this checkoff self-help program, then how do we promote U.S. beef so aggressively in the overseas marketplace? If we don't have this checkoff program, then how do we continue to fund such outstanding consumer information programs and promotion programs like the National Beef Cook-Off? How do we get that nutrition information that you heard about a few minutes ago into the minds of consumers? How do we reach health professionals? How do we reach educators? How do we reach food editors? Who doesn't without a beef checkoff program? And who steps up to the plate and finds the intervention strategies to make sure that the U.S. beef supply is the safest and most wholesome in the world? I haven't heard the critics of your program answer those questions. Now, we've tried to approach this battle over the beef checkoff, thanks to the stalwart leadership that you've provided us, by making sure that our messages about the beef checkoff are based in fact and always truthful. And that's as it should be. We've tried to stay on the high road with those messages and keep our vision focused on building beef demand. But there are some folks down in the weeds on the side of that road that I'd like to pull us down there with them. And you know what? They don't always encumber themselves by telling the truth. Now, if it's intentional, if they intentionally misrepresent your checkoff program, if they deliberately confuse the roles of the beef checkoff, the beef board, the beef council, and the CBA, if they deliberately cloud the differences between what your beef checkoff can do and what must be done with dues money in the public policy arena, make no mistake about it. They're headed for one objective, and that is to kill your beef checkoff program. We even have a judge in South Dakota, Dee referred to him a bit, who has not only restricted our producer communications activities, he has actually limited our vocabulary in conducting producer communications about your beef checkoff. There's some things he told us we can't even say. In our producer communications program, we cannot say your beef checkoff is working, even though every one of you know it is. We cannot say that your beef checkoff program is effective and efficient, even though you make sure that it is. And the thing that really puzzles me is we can't even say your beef checkoff program is producer controlled, and yet you are the producers who control it. What a golden opportunity you have in the course of the next 3 days here in Nashville to join in that battle to defend your beef checkoff program. How do you do that? I think the best way you do it is to make this already outstanding program that is the envy of other commodity promotion efforts around the country. You make this beef checkoff even better. If you think it works, then you make it work harder. You do that by asking the tough questions in your committee meetings. You do that by not running from the difficult decisions in those committee meetings. If you think this checkoff program is effective and efficient, you make it even more so. And if you think this program is or ought to be producer controlled, then take control of it in those meetings. Take control of it back home when you carry that checkoff message about what you've learned at these meetings here in Nashville. Because, you see, it's not just about the future of the beef checkoff. It's about the future of our industry. It's about your future. It's about your children's future. Let's dedicate ourselves in these next 3 days of meetings to make the kinds of decisions, engage in the kind of debate, and go home with the kind of enthusiasm for our industry and the programs we fund together that makes that future as bright as it can possibly be. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
We have one final highlight. Our leadership in the future is in safe hands. I'd like to introduce to you now the two men who are going to lead us this next year. First, the incoming president-elect of MCBA, Mr. Eric Davis, and the vice chair of the Academy's Beat Board, Andy Tucker. Let's just stand here together, guys. A couple of questions for incoming leaders. First, I'll turn to Andy and ask him, you know, what do you see coming down the way here for this group?
Well, what I see from watching the program today, I see enthusiasm and I see pride. You know, I'm a former Marine and a Vietnam vet, and watching that opening that we saw and listened to you, it makes me want to lock up, you know, and go through the leader. And he said our industry is patriotic. We have former vets here, we have former military people, parents have sons and daughters. Nelson and Elizabeth Curry from Kentucky, their son is a Screaming Eagle now, and he's probably on his way over there. So I want us to take that enthusiasm, that pride into the meeting.
What are we going to take forward?
Dave, I see a lot of opportunities in front of this industry and in front of our organizations both. And I see challenges. And I'm not going to enumerate them. That's what we're here for this week, is to talk about all of these issues and how we think we're going to best address them. But what I really see are the people right up there that are going to provide those answers for us, and your leadership and your board and your staff are going to do our darndest to implement the policies and the programs that you set here this week.
And Eric, what advice do you have for the people for the rest of this meeting?
We're here for a reason. We came to set our policies for the coming year, to prioritize our programs for the coming year, and you have, as our members, the opportunity to be a part of that process through the councils, through the committees, through your representation on the board, and with your membership vote Saturday afternoon. Don't waste that opportunity. Be a part of it. Win, lose, or draw. Believe in the democracy of this country and stay committed to the outcome of the votes, and then we'll be able to do what you suggested that we do, and that is to do what needs to be done to get the job done, hang together, and we will show this world what we can do. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. And it wouldn't be fair, Eric, if we didn't get Andy a shot at that same question. What's your advice to?
Well, Dave, I appreciate it. What I would ask you, that enthusiasm and pride I talked about, I want you to take the enthusiasm into the meetings and remember you represent the folks from home. And while you're representing them, I want you to write down 10 things. We had a pile of information that was presented to us here today, and it's good stuff. Good stuff to take home. Write down 10 Remember too, pray to your head, don't put it too close like I used to, but remember too that you can go home and talk to your friends, your neighbors, and people around you, your contemporaries, that you can tell them about the program. That's what.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Andy. Gentlemen, thank you. Best of luck in this next year.
Meeting wouldn't be complete without saying thank you. My grandmother said you should say please, but don't forget to say thank you. I'd like to thank all the people who worked hard on this program. I'd like to thank you for your dedication and your investment in this organization. And I'd like to thank the good Lord for bringing us all together today. It's often been said that we should take our work seriously and ourselves lightly. I think cattlemen are serious about their work and the job that they do, but I think they have a sense of humor. So if you'll watch with me this final clip, we'll end with a sense of humor.